good. I think this is a Bloggy Heads version of what I thought would be our little debate on C-SPAN a few months ago. We were both on C-SPAN on like the week when they had people who've never been on C-SPAN before and
yes.
probably don't belong on C-SPAN.
Yeah, they haven't called me back for some reason.
They haven't called me back either. I think they were a little shocked. They were like, well, this is our week for people who've never been on before, but you look like kind of an old Washington hand. I don't know what they expected. But yeah, no, I was driving in and driving down to do the C-SPAN thing at 6:30 in the morning, and they said, and appearing, you know, in their next hour, Mark Schmidt and Megan McArdle. And I thought, oh, this will be fun. And then I got there and found out we were actually back to back rather than getting to argue with each other.
Yes, I think I spent most of the hour with dealing with the crazies who dialed in. I had one guy who just started like sort of spewing profanity, and the woman just sort of cut him off really quickly.
Right, right. Well, I made the mistake of telling the people who are convinced that there's a plan for a total North American unification and one currency called the Amero for all the that there's a secret plot to impose this on them, that they were actually wrong, that there wasn't a secret plot to impose
a single North American currency. Watch C-SPAN, right?
Because yeah, and you wouldn't believe the amount of emails I got about what a patsy I was and how I'd believe any fall for anything, and of course. You know, since I've spent the last 6 years realizing that you shouldn't be, you could be too much of a patsy, I started to wonder if they might be right.
Yeah, I got the Ron Paul people a lot. Oh, yeah. I'm not a huge fan of Ron Paul, and so I get, of course, the libertarians who are just like, you know, why are you betraying Dr. Paul? But also the more general, the deep arguments about the gold standard and why I'm against it.
Right.
Anyway, so what should we argue about today?
Get drummed out of your movement there.
I get drummed out of the movement. All the movements I'm in, I regularly get drummed out of them. It's like a once a week activity.
Right, right. Well, that's a good identity, and then you could be like the David Horowitz of the libertarians.
I actually got into an argument the last time I was in Philadelphia. The second to last time I was in Philadelphia with someone who actually told me I wasn't a woman. It's like,
oh, that's interesting.
Wow, I could get. Yeah, it was actually someone like a friend of a friend of a friend. Who is heavy into the feminist movement and just was like, you know, you can't say those things and be a woman. And it was like, well, I feel like I've got the 2X chromosomes, and that's really all the carrying card I need. But
all right, well, I want to know, I'm going to add to our agenda here at the end, what were those things that you
okay.
said? Okay, but let's start because there were two interesting columns, op-eds today that – came from totally different angles at the question at the sort of point that the Democratic Party is now the party of the rich. One was Paul Krugman, who was basically kind of worrying that with a lot of support from the wealthy that Democrats would kind of get sort of squishy about the sort of populism and social justice that is the rightful agenda of the party. And the other was by a guy named Michael Frank writing in the FT. With virtually identical column, but of course coming from a different place, and basically saying, you know, if the Democrats are the party of the rich, then they really are talking about tax increases on the rich. You know, do they seriously think that their constituents are going to put up with this for long? And kind of the two columns almost getting to the converging at the same point, which is to conclude that maybe it's, you know, that essentially you could have a party that's kind of about nothing because their constituency and their constituency's self-interest are sort of at odds, which I thought was I thought they were both fascinating columns, although I am much more sanguine about the ability of you know, well-off people in this country to understand that they actually have a stake in the overall well-being of the country. And I think thinking about, you know, healthcare is something that we're going to have to pay more for, and that's actually a good thing for business. I don't think the self-interest is going to completely cripple the Democratic agenda. And of course, the flip side of it is that you've got a Republican Party that increasingly relies on you know, very low income people, and they're really not offering much for that constituency. The Michael Frank op-ed talked about, you know, compared the people who live in Pelosi's district and Steny Hoyer's district in Maryland and Chris Van Hollen's district in Maryland. He's the Democratic Congressional Committee chair, how the, comparing the districts of the Democratic leadership to the Republican leadership. The Roy Blonde of Missouri, you know, represents a very, very low income district in Missouri. I mean, I think it's as much a dilemma for the Republicans as for the Democrats. So I just, I don't know. I wanted to kind of talk about those two things because I feel like it's suddenly the agenda of the domestic agenda of the moment.
Well, I think it's interesting, right? Because I think that there is this distinction. When you talk about the Democrats being the party of the rich, it becomes partly a question of who the rich are, right? To Paul Krugman, I think the rich are people who have a lot more money than Paul Krugman. Mm-hmm. I don't think he thinks of himself as being in the plutocratic class of people who have unjustly earned their excessive salaries. And I think the Democrats are the party of people who have I probably shouldn't swear on blogging heads, but what a lot of people call sort of fuck you money is it just doesn't matter anymore how much money they make.
Right.
And so taxes, yeah.
There is no other word for that concept. It's like one of those things where the only word is in French. There's really no.
Exactly. And unfortunately, as I realized when I opened up my old college copy of my old high school copy of The Stranger, that my French is no longer good enough to find those words.
So you have to rely on profanity, even though this will now guarantee that this will not be one of those blogging heads that the New York Times links to.
Oh, dear, is that true, do you think?
That's, well, we'll find out, right?
But I think that the thing is that the people who have that much money, it doesn't matter how much they pay in taxes to them, because it's at this point the money is like a positional good. You know, right. you're climbing up the Fortune 500, 400 list of richest people, Forbes, I guess. Forbes is this list of the 400 richest people in the world. And you'll still be, you know, your position won't be changed by the taxes. For the people for whom money actually buys utility lower down the scale, those people tend to still vote Republican, particularly if, unlike Paul Krugman, their salaries are actually dependent on a more competitive market. Providing goods to people lower down the income scale,
right? And it's in a middle. It's not true that rich people vote. I mean, the greatest Democratic vote is still lower income people. It's in that middle zone that you get a lot of Republicans, and they don't, and I think you're right. They don't have much in common. I mean, to me, it's always funny when. You know, when people like George Soros, and I used to work for George Soros' foundation and so forth, or Warren Buffett are sort of brought out. And I think, you know, Warren Buffett, I think he's right. He's very powerful when he says I shouldn't pay taxes at a lower rate than my secretary. On the other hand,
right. And by the way,
the ordinary $80,000 business person doesn't actually have much in common with Warren Buffett.
Right. And those are the people, and this is actually a big part of the problem when talking about raising taxes on the rich, because the fact is that there aren't that many of them. Mm-hmm. And so you get this thing where there's this, I mean, in a way, almost theological argument between Republicans and Democrats over who got the biggest benefit from the Bush tax cut. And as a as individuals, the rich got a bigger benefit, right? Mm-hmm. But as a class, they got a smaller benefit because there just aren't that many of them. And this is actually an issue for the Democrats who have been going out on the campaign trail and talking about how they're going to pay for all these things by raising taxes on the rich. But the fact is, you can quickly get to levels where the Laffer curve, which I've repeatedly said does not apply at U.S. taxation levels, it doesn't. But as you raise the taxes higher and higher with the rich, especially because their money is more fungible, you actually can get to levels where the Laffer curve applies. And so you don't have that much scope to just raise taxes on the rich. An optimal tax policy sort of doesn't work that way.
Well, do you think that the Laffer curve applied – on the tax at the level of the tax rates after the 86 tax reform?
I think the 86 tax reform is extremely complicated because it wasn't just a tax. It's more lower taxes on a broader base, which is great. I mean, I think that the 1986 tax reform is like the unsung hero of the Reagan administration. I think it was a terrific reform, and I think it's pretty disappointing actually that the Clinton administration spent so much.
Congressional Democrats, but okay.
Well, we can argue about who's responsible.
I work for Bill Bradley, so I see it from and I didn't work for him at that time, but I see it from that perspective.
But from both sides, right? Mm-hmm. I think that this was a great idea that unfortunately the Clinton administration spent a huge amount of time undoing with all of these targeted tax cuts, and the Bush administration has just continued in this terrible vein of, like, you know, 8 zillion little tax credits for every single thing that people ever might think about doing that isn't, like, molesting children. Right.
But you have a tax credit for not molesting children.
Yeah, we should. That's what we need. We need a tax break for not molesting children, because otherwise,
reasonably well, you know, you were reasonably well behaved this year. Take a tax credit.
That's right. The problem is compliance, of course. How do you ensure that they didn't molest children? But I, you know, back to this tax break. I actually think that this, what both of the op-eds are actually arguing about is this tax break for hedge funds.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something called carried interest, which I won't explain because I assume that our readers already got 8 hours of sleep last night. But it's...
Well, what this is, let's explain a little bit. It's a couple different ways in which income of partnerships are treated as if they're capital gains and taxed at a lower rate rather than as salary compensation.
Right.
And it's basically some definitional questions about when you treat it that way and when you don't.
And I would agree, you know, I'm not crazily interested in the subject of the carried interest tax, but it doesn't really seem to be that defensible to me to treat hedge fund earnings is carried in as a capital gain rather than these particular hedge fund earnings in which the partners have no money. I mean, the main thing is that the partners are getting taxed on capital gains in hedge funds, but they don't actually have any money at stake. So they're being taxed at stuff they earn as if it were a capital gain. But it's a tiny thing. And this actually, I think, reinforces something that I've said on a couple of different blogging heads now, which is that to the extent that parties have interest groups that they reward, they can do so when what's at stake is very small. Special interests can capture parties and get sort of minor concessions out of them, right? Like, no one except you and me knows what the carried interest is or cares. And Paul Krugman will write a column about it, and some of his people, the people who read him, will get all outraged. But those people aren't going to vote on it. No one's going to vote on it. It's just not that big a deal, which is why Chuck Schumer is able, despite being a New York Democrat, is able to be shielding his hedge fund constituents in this way.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to big things, parties don't have nearly as much latitude to cater to special interests as people give them credit for. You know, like things like CAFE standards, where the Republicans are usually on this portrayed as being in hoc to big oil or in hoc to big auto. But in fact, like, the auto workers unions are the ones who are against this. And there's a lot of them, and they vote, which means Michigan will block this. And unless you want to get into a huge brawl with your Michigan senators, you know, you don't push CAFE standards forward.
Right.
Because for people who don't know, the plants that are making light trucks tend to be disproportionately profitable and concentrated in areas with a lot of auto workers who vote Democratic and Republican. So anyway, this is you can give away small concessions, but when you're looking at something big, like the overall level of taxation, like the estate tax, like CAFE standards, like environmental standards, any of that, you aren't looking at special interests. What you're looking at is huge blocks of voters who are swayed, who are disproportionately motivated on this consideration.
I think that's generally true. I've always felt, and I've done a lot of stuff on campaign finance reform and so forth, I've always felt that there's a naivete about the relationship between campaign donations and votes, you know, It's not like if you're, for example, a senator from New Jersey, sure, you're going to get a fair amount of campaign contributions that are attributable to the pharmaceutical industry, either, you know, executives or people who work there, or if you take PAC money, potentially through their PACs. But if you didn't get any of that, you'd still be very responsive to the pharmaceutical industry.
Right.
And
because
partly because they're very well mobilized and sort of persuade you that this is the key industry in the state, even if it's not necessarily the key industry of the state. But it's partly because they are, and there are a lot of people represented there. And if you're, you know, if you're from Connecticut, you know, you're responsive to the insurance industry and so forth. Obviously, hedge fund people are a much smaller group.
Right.
On the other hand, I mean, if Chuck Schumer were here doing this blogging heads, he would say, finance is the driver of the New York City economy. And there's an argument about why it's not, but you know he's convinced it is. So
But the thing is, like, I would actually agree with him. It is the driver of the New York City economy. And we could debate that. I think it's just.
I just saw a great report the other day about how it's really kind of the creative, the creative class actually drives the New York economy.
But whether or not you think that's true,
I'm not going to argue that.
But the thing that I would argue with Chuck Schumer, and then I really doubt he'd have a good answer for, or one that would satisfy me, is that, yes, it is, but the hedge fund guys aren't going to suddenly decamp from New York City because, first of all, it's a national tax. They're not all going to move to Bermuda because you're taxing carried interest, because, frankly, they don't want to live in Bermuda. They want to live in the United States. They're U.S. citizens. You can get rich people to leave. Britain did when it had these, like, 98% taxes. People did move abroad. But at the level that we're talking about, which is shifting from a 15% capital gains tax to a 30% marginal income tax rate, they're not going to leave. They're not going to leave New York.
Right.
They're not going to leave anywhere. They're not going to stop being hedge fund managers.
Right.
They're not going to make less money. There's very few of them, and they're making gigantic fortunes. I should say my ex-boyfriend is manages an incredibly small hedge fund. Mm-hmm. It's him. That doesn't make, that kind of money. And he is the kind of guy who might be affected by this, right? Like, he's the kind of guy that if you tax the carried interest, he might look at his income and say, well, I could make more money at Goldman.
Mm-hmm.
But
those
guys, there aren't that many of them.
Right.
I have no
view on whether we should have, whether people should be working at hedge funds or working at Goldman or whatever. The fact that it's a tax policy that drives people to say, I'd rather be running a little hedge fund than, have a basically compensated job somewhere else, even if compensation is, $1.5 million bonus or whatever. The fact that it's distorting people's professional choices is a problem in itself.
Right. No, I would agree with that. And I think that there's not I'm a libertarian. I think that you can make a market aficionado and so forth. So I think you can make a good argument that that taxes should be lower, but I don't think that you can make a good argument that taxes between capital and income should be different, except it's really complicated because then you get into corporate income tax and what happens there. But at this particular metric, I certainly don't think that there's a good argument for treating this as capital gains in order to encourage more people to go into the hedge fund industry.
Right.
So I would say that we're definitely on the same page here, that this
both columns used the hedge fund tax issues as a sort of gateway into the Democrats as the party of the rich question. You know, to me, I've found that actually to be a sort of exaggerated issue because Yes, it died in the Senate. It wasn't like it had momentum and then died in the Senate. And there are two reasons. Like, I'm sort of happy to see it die in the Senate for two reasons. One, you should save something like that for something that you're then going to pay for something with. So you sort of save your good off. You could see this come back.
Right.
That's
a really good point.
As a way of paying for CHIP or something like that. And I also would rather I'd rather see an overall rebalancing of capital gains and dividend income so that it's all treated the same way. And I don't want the best cases, the real money bags, examples with like Stephen Schwarzman of the Blackstone Group, for example, who's colossal beneficiary of this rule. I don't want those examples to be off the table, because otherwise you only do have the sort of smaller the sort of smaller fry who might be affected. So
I would caveat this by saying that I think that capital gains and dividend income should be lower as long as there's a corporate income tax. I think that the trade off for raising the capital gains tax should be eliminating the corporate income tax, but
that's probably
a discussion for another day.
I've always been attracted to that idea, and I wish there were a one-to-one trade-off that you could get rid of the corporate income tax and then crank everything up. I mean, you're going to have to make up a lot of revenue if you got rid of the corporate income tax, even if
it doesn't
you did.
Actually raise that much revenue. And like, I actually think the corporate income tax is somewhere where there is a huge potential for what they call rebound effects for viewers out there. You know, when that I think that you would find that even if you just got rid of it, you wouldn't lose as much revenue as it raises, just because the corporate income tax generates so much completely stupid, useless economic activity aimed at getting around it.
Well, absolutely.
I think you would see a lot of economic growth just getting rid of all of this.
Well, I think you would, and I think you'd free up some retained earnings as well.
Yes.
But all of that's kind of speculative, and there's still you're going to need another tranche of revenue to make up for that. I mean,
once you've gotten rid of it, the obvious thing is that there's no reason to have I guess there are a lot of people who disagree with me and would say that investment is special and that therefore we should have a consumption tax, which this is sort of a proxy for. But I personally don't think, certainly dividend income, and I would also argue capital gains income, should then just be rolled into the progressive income tax. But which would raise, I think, quite a lot of revenue to offset the loss of the corporate income tax.
Right. Not all of it, but it would raise a lot.
But I think when you combine that with the rebound effect, you'd basically get it back, and actually a little extra.
Right. Well, you'd have to score it that way.
Yeah. Well, and it would be controversial, and no one will ever do it. I'm full of tax plans that no one will do, like eliminating the mortgage interest tax deduction.
Right. Well, this one is sort of closer to doable than some of the consumption tax. Than some of the consumption tax ideas. Well, you've successfully diverted my political conversation to a tax.
Well, no, but I should just wrap up by saying that my thing about this in general is that I don't care if the Democrats are the party of the rich, because I think that when you're talking about this very small number of people, they really don't have that much opportunity to influence the Democrats in the way that people are being afraid, right? Mm-hmm. Having a party, even if all of the people who make more than, I don't know, $300,000 a year support the Democrats, right? They can't torpedo national health care. I'm against national health care, but if it was something that like should happen and the great mass of the American people wanted it, they can't torpedo it. It doesn't matter how much money they give to campaigns. They don't vote. There aren't enough of them. And that is ultimately the arithmetic that matters the most, is who is the motivated voter. And the wealthy are motivated and they donate to campaigns and so forth, but there just aren't enough of them to overcome anything that has massive popular support. So I'm less concerned. I think the carried interest tax thing is bad and so forth, but in the grand scheme of things, it really doesn't keep me awake at night. And I think the number of things that the wealthy, the rich or whatever are able to get for themselves, wouldn't keep me awake at night.
Okay. I kind of agree with that. I mean, I do think, obviously, I mean, you see a certain effect, and I'll give you an example. When they talked about taxing the rich, and I sort of hate getting into this for this particular reason. Raising taxes on the rich started off at $200,000, and then Schumer, I think, started talking about it as $300,000, $350,000. Then Pelosi talked about it as $500,000. So there's this kind of inflation. In fact, if you represent wealthy districts, obviously, you know plenty of people in Manhattan, you know plenty of people in Nancy Pelosi's district for whom, you know, $500,000 still leaves you feeling like, where's my giant apartment on Park Avenue? I was supposed to, this is supposed to be rich, and it isn't. So there's a kind of inflating up of what's considered rich when your people are from these kind of, super wealthy counties. You know, Jamie Galbraith of the University of Texas has this kind of controversial study, but his argument is like all the inequality in America is in 10 counties and 90% of it is in 5 counties in this country,
right?
You know, Fairfield County, Silicon Valley, and so forth.
Which really means that there isn't that much inequality in America, because frankly, aside from some sort of tradable consumer goods, like, so they have better plasma TVs than most of us, but in fact, most of the things they buy are things like real estate that aren't tradable, and where all of these rich people are just bidding up the prices on other rich people. It is interesting to me, because I went to a private school in Manhattan, and everyone there referred to themselves as being middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone there really thought of themselves as being middle class, because in fact, I grew up I grew up in an apartment that was maybe 2,000 square feet, on the Upper West Side, worth, when my parents sold it, a fantastic amount of money. They bought it for like $28,000 in 1973, but you know, we didn't have a lavish lifestyle. We didn't. My family never took.
As I consider, you say those were. You say 2,000 square foot apartment on the Upper West Side. That's pretty. You know,
that's
the interesting thing. I mean,
it's
we've got
fantastically valuable, but you compare it to what people in the suburbs were living in—the kind of personal space that you have and a yard—and like we didn't have a lot of amenities. We were sinking it in just to the location of our apartment. Sort of 90% of everything that my parents brought in was sunk into two things, educating their kids and having an apartment in a good location. And you know, obviously, like, I'm not – but the fact is, like, when you compare their actual consumption beyond just the education of their apartment, it didn't look – you know, we didn't take vacations. We didn't have a lot of clothes. Everything was about educating us and having this apartment because of where we – you know, my dad worked and so forth. My dad worked for the mayor for a while, and so they felt middle class. You know, they had a non-middle class income, but they felt middle class precisely because they were, you know, all they ended up doing was just paying a fortune for things that people get in other areas for a lot less money.
Right.
So the consumption inequality is a lot lower than, you know, the measured inequality, I would say. And you get all of these people in Manhattan who consider themselves middle class on like $600,000 a year. It's awesome.
Yeah, but it's also obnoxious.
It is.
It's ridiculous. I mean, you've got to have some perspective on where you stand on where you are in the world, and so you've chosen to consume it in this way, which is to live in New York, you know, as opposed to living in a giant house in, you know, Bedminster, New Jersey, and having a big plasma TV, which is a whole different kind of dealing with wealth. And the real key is the kind of level of security that you have. You know, and a lot of the people in this country are kind of living on the edge, and the fact is, if you have an apartment you own in Manhattan and those things, you have a colossal level of basic economic security.
I don't know. I think I would argue that – I mean, I'm not entirely defending this. And I certainly think if you live in Manhattan, you have options, right? Mm-hmm. But when it's on the county level, you have fewer. You know, if you're talking about someone who lives in Silicon Valley, it's not really realistic. They couldn't earn that income and then go live in, like, Indiana. They sort of have to consume all of these things like housing and education that they end up spending a fortune on because they're competing with all of these other people who have high salaries. I would just say that I don't disagree with you, right? But I do think that the apparent inequality, when you just look at the income numbers, is much, much lower, higher than the actual inequality in terms of ability to have the ingredients of a decent life. And yes, they do have economic security. I'm not in any way trying to argue that I grew up in the same way that some kid growing up in Missouri on $30,000 a year or whatever did. I'm just saying that when it's geographical, they feel middle class. It's kind of silly and kind of obnoxious, but it's also, especially outside of Manhattan, where when you're talking about large urban areas, you know, yes, I could move to Indiana and I wouldn't have as high a cost of living, but my salary would also be cut in half. So it doesn't actually – a lot of it, when you're starting to get into outlying suburbs and so forth, a lot of that really does, I think, come out in the wash.
Now, there is also the problem. I mean, I'm on the other side of this argument, but, you know, the current generation of your parents, people who work for the mayor of New York, I mean, I don't know anything about your family, but I'll just speculate here. The current generation of your parents is going to have a much harder time doing that thing, which is have a good sized apartment and afford what are basically the, you know, I don't know what school you went to, but, you know, the world's greatest schools are those private schools in New York.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of amazing. I just went to a memorial service for my college roommate's father from Washington. You know, he was a professor. They lived in a very nice house right near National Cathedral here and sent three kids to St. Albans and National Cathedral School, which are also, you know, very fine schools, on basically an academic salary. That's kind of amazing, and that's much harder to do
In New York,
you know, for people who are 30 now.
No. I think that's true, but you also have to – like, it is true, and the geographic problems in New York are getting bigger and bigger because just so many people want to live there. But I would also say, you know, yes, my parents had a big apartment. There were prostitutes on our corner.
Mm-hmm.
There were homeless people wandering around the street. You know, there was a famous Law & Order episode where some homeless guy pushes someone into traffic. That happened. That was my block. It was two blocks from me on 96th. And the reason people want to live in New York now is that it isn't the city that my parents bought an apartment in 1973.
Right, right.
My mother says she wouldn't have lived where if she and my dad's 6'7", and she said, like, I was talking about I've been thinking about buying a house in the D.C. area, and the neighborhoods that I was looking at, this actually might be a good segue into one of the topics that we're going to talk about, which is gentrification and so forth. One of the neighborhoods that I was looking at, my mother said, you can't live there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have some issues with that. But she was like, you know, I wouldn't have lived on the Upper West Side where we lived if it hadn't been for Frank, my dad, mm-hmm. Who's 6'7". And, you know, she would have been afraid to be alone there at night. And that's not it's not unreasonable to say, like, so yeah, they really lucked out.
Right,
my parents did.
Right.
But you can still do that. You can still live in a crappy neighborhood somewhere. You just can't do it. It's just the crappy
just
neighborhood.
It's
no
just
longer in the middle of Manhattan.
It's just not. I mean, you know, we got priced out of Brooklyn, and I think, you know, you'd have to go beyond Bed-Stuy to really live in that way. In a way that you can that you can raise a family at that point. I have a friend with an apartment in the Dakota, and you realize what they did was they took a gamble at a time when that was a really daring thing. They actually took a huge risk.
Right.
Buying an apartment in New York in 1973 or 1977. That's kind of, you know, they sort of deserve some of the returns to that risk.
Because it looked like it was just going to keep going down
right.
forever. And the reason
right.
my parents bought in the city was that my dad worked for them at the time. Worked for, I guess, Abe Beam or Ed Koch. I'm a little hazy on when it turned over, but he worked for both of them, and, like, you know, they had to live in the city. The assistant to the mayor can't go, you know, be in the suburbs
right.
somewhere. So,
right. But it's also, like, the greatest place to live in the world.
No,
I mean,
it is.
Yeah,
it's
just a fabulous place to live.
I'm actually pretty fond of D.C. now. I'm a transplant. I moved here last year, and I'm really enjoying it. But I think we could move on to gentrification, which I think is a conversation I've been having with a lot of friends. Is I live on U Street, which is a neighborhood that has been historically a black middle-class neighborhood and is now gentrifying ferociously.
Right.
And there's a huge number of condos going up. And Mark, you lived there, I know.
I lived in that area in the 90s when there was sort of repeated attempts to – I lived at 17th and U, when there were sort of repeated attempts to gentrify further to the east, and they kind of – there would be a little crime wave, and it would kind of all fall back again.
Well, this is the thing that I feel that I'm really conflicted about, and I guess my white liberal guilt or whatever, is that, you know, my mother's just moved here.
You're the first person with libertarian guilt.
Yes. well, you know, we were going to – my mother's just moved here, and she's a huge foodie, and I'm a pretty big foodie. So yesterday we drove past the D.C. Farmers Market, and we went in, and it's this fantastic place. If anyone lives in D.C. and hasn't been – it's in, I think, Northeast. I'm still not so good on directions here, but I think it's in Northeast D.C. It's right around Florida Avenue and 4th, and it's this amazing place. But you know, we're going through. My mother was like, "Finally!" You know, she also likes Eastern Market, but she's like, "Finally, it's fantastic! Finally, there's real food, and it's a place for real people. It's not like Whole Foods, which she hates going into because she feels like it's just all too precious." And I was really enjoying it. And then I was like, you know, but the problem is that the reason that we like this so much is that there are people here of modest incomes, and this is where they shop. And so it's set up for them. There's no pretense about it. It's not pretty. The meat place kind of smells a little bit. And this is what my mom loved about the Upper West Side. And she hated – by the time it was done gentrifying, she hated it and left.
Right.
And the problem is, though, right, like, we want to be the only people who go there. We don't want other people, other upper-middle-class people to go to this market because that will ruin it, and then it will just be Whole Foods down there, and everyone will sit around and talk about its roots as a historical, authentic farmer's market rather than it actually being a historical, authentic market. And this is the problem with U Street. For everyone I know who lives here loves it, but they're looking at the condos going up and thinking, you know, in 5 years, I have to move because I can't stand living near all of the people who want to move into those condos.
Right.
But the other thing that but you know, that's all sort of a little bit precious and your aesthetic objection to the other people who live in the condos is kind of snotty. But there's a real thing, which is that, you know, the people hunting a place that isn't so relentlessly chain stores and upscale. you chase out the very people that you want to live around, which is a mixed neighborhood where there's all different kinds of income and all different kinds of jobs, and not just everyone. U Street seems to be these days half composed of journalists and people who work for think tanks. Mm-hmm. And it's just getting more so every year. And what do you do about that? And should I feel guilty, Mark, is what I really want to know.
No, I mean, I think people overthink these things. I mean, I think sometimes it's a question of whether people are being – we often have the idea that gentrification kind of drives people out of neighborhoods, and sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, you know, it's funny. Where we lived in Brooklyn, it was gentrifying rapidly, and it was old Italian neighborhood. But, you know, it was – nobody was unhappy. Like, most of the people who were moving out, their idea was – well, that's the neighborhood my grandfather. I don't want to live in the neighborhood my grandfather lived in. That's for the old timers. I want to move to the suburbs. So right. there was a sort of happy gentrification in a neighborhood like that. And obviously the point where it's a kind of mixed balance. I mean one reason I don't like DC as much is because as New York is because the neighborhoods often there's often a kind of natural segregation. There's very little kind of mixed neighborhood, and to the extent there is, it may be only in that moment of the yeah. process of gentrification. I think it's been right now the area where you live, it's one of those few it's one of the few areas where one feels like black and white Washington meet and mingle, and maybe that will shift. I mean, maybe in 5 years, that's going to be just another province of white Washington, and sort of DuPont Circle East. But maybe it will continue to be like that. And the question is, what kind of things would one do? You know, schools have a huge part to do with this as well. And I want to get a little bit to some of your thoughts about school vouchers and. That would respond to it. But one reason why you're going to move out of that neighborhood, not, your cohort is going to move out of that neighborhood, you don't want to live in a condo forever in a place where you don't, where you don't need to live in a condo. But B, you're good, you don't have good enough schools in that neighborhood. Now, if you have good enough schools, you'd kind of keep a lot of the families, and you'd probably keep a little more of a mix.
Yeah, I think there's a it might be a good segue to go to school vouchers. I think there's in New York, I went to a mixed income school. It was about half middle class and half.
Wait, middle class or your friends who all consider themselves middle class?
Well, you have to understand this was in the early 80s. I went to PS166 for grammar school. Oh, okay. In the early 80s, there wasn't a lot of the income segregation in New York now is staggering.
Yeah.
And it's really. Like, you can see it in my old neighborhood. What you have now, and I think the process will be complete in another 10 years, is you actually got this real issue with – my dad was pointing this out. Increasingly – so they built all these housing projects on the Upper West Side, which is why for years and years it didn't gentrify when everything else was on the Upper West Side. Like, when I was growing up, I actually wasn't allowed to go north of 96th Street. My dad now lives on 101st and Broadway. The housing projects, which have more crime associated with them and so forth, they kept people from gentrifying, and now the pressure is just so great that it's surged over the housing projects anyway, mm-hmm. and no one cares anymore, and crime has dropped so much too. Mm-hmm. But the problem is now what you have is these islands where I lived in one of them, and this was starting – it had actually really start already happened to them. You used to have Amsterdam and Columbus had retail that was focused on poor people.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Because that's where the housing projects have been erected in the 60s and 70s.
There's also, by the way, there's more. I mean, one of the unique things about only in New York things is middle class people live in housing projects.
Yeah, there's middle income housing projects.
You do have middle class families in those projects along Amsterdam.
But that is changing because those were mostly Mitchell-Lama projects, the middle income things, and those are all they're losing the. There was a tax deal where now people are starting to exit the Mitchell-Lama program.
Right.
There was a 25-year deal.
Right. And we should explain the Mitchell-Lama program, but I think that's another one.
Yes. Anyway, it was a program that gave you – you had to build housing for middle-income or low-income people, and you had to do it for 25 years, you got a tax credit, right. And now that's right. And people right. are starting to pull their buildings out because they've right. That 25-year period has expired.
But so, we're evading vouchers. We're evading the tax.
Yes.
Go to it.
Go to. So I mean, went move, to this.
No, tell the story, but then.
Yeah, but yeah. but the retail is disappearing for these people. So you have islands where you've got a housing project full of poor people, but there's nowhere for them to shop. The right. grocery stores are getting too expensive. I was shopping in like the last sort of south of 96th Street grocery store that served poor people. It had like no vegetables mm-hmm. And about 87 kinds of tripe.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so there's nowhere for them to shop, and this is actually a serious thing. Like, where when D'Agostino's and Whole Foods are the only grocery stores, where are people who live in housing projects supposed to get things that they can afford to eat and wear and so forth? They're having to travel further and further for the basic amenities of their life.